Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains, to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. So if you'd like some help building some great software or are interested in finding a great place to work, do check their links in the description below. I first met my guest today in an interview. He'd applied to work at ThoughtWorks, and I was the last of his interviewers for the job. He was clearly very experienced, very good, and also an excellent fit for the organisation. So, of course, we hired him, and I'm very pleased that we did. He's now, nearly two decades later, still working there as a software architect and director. He's also a member of the ThoughtWorks Technical Advisory Board, who produce the widely used technology radar that recommends which ideas and technologies to adopt and which to discard. He's also now an internationally recognized expert on software architecture and design and what it takes to achieve great results through technology, organization design, and lean product development. He also happens to be the co-author of the first ever article to identify, describe, and define microservices. So please welcome my guest today, my friend James Lewis. Hi, James. Thank you for coming.
Hey, Dave. Thank you for inviting me, and thanks very much for that very kind intro. I feel like I've got a lot to live up to. Did I do all
that? Well, you did, I think. So let's start with the thing that you're probably best known for, which is microservices. We've got a lot to cover because you're a very Renaissance man. You've got a wide range of interests, I know, and we share some of them, many of them. So let's talk about microservices. So where did it come from? What were the key steps in its emergence from your point of view?
So that's a great question. Where did microservices come from? Because I mean, it obviously wasn't me, right? I mean, this was I've spoken about this widely. You know, I've always. Actually, Jim Webber is a mutual friend of ours. He drilled it into me that you should always attribute your sources, right? And that's been much to my detriment sometimes, where I could have claimed credit for things that I possibly haven't done. But it's, you know, obviously it's about standing on the shoulders of giants, microservices. You know, we were in a place when I think about when I started programming, which was about actually properly professional programming, because I was a sysadmin before. It was pretty about 2000, 2001. And then over the course of the next sort of four or so years, I got into XP, you know, CI, got into sort of, you know, test first and refactoring, all these interesting ideas, and then joined ThoughtWorks, as you mentioned, but in 2005. Yeah. And of course, suddenly in ThoughtWorks, you find yourself surrounded by a bunch of really interesting people, especially at that time in London. There was I mean, obviously you were there yourself, but there was also this. I think we've hired pretty much the London XP community, right? At this point,
yeah,
more or less. So you know, so there's all these super interesting people doing really interesting things, in terms of XP, but also in terms of things like large scale systems design. How do you do integration? Thinking about how we build software, especially server side, you know, back end software, whose components are decoupled from one another, or the services are decoupled from one another. I spent quite a long time on projects in banks where you're building, you know, services for use by many, many other clients, and thinking about, you know, looking at things like SOAP RPC and document-oriented SOAP, and God, this is on Corba actually predating that. You're thinking, this is really hard. You know, every time we need to make a change, we've got to rebuild the software, we've got to redeploy it, you've got to fill out the tickets. Hey, you know, classic example of solving the wrong, or having to solve the wrong problem, but, you know, automate using like web testing tools to automate the driving of the form that you'd have to submit your war into in order for it to go over to be deployed by the operations team, you know. So yeah. I mean, but maybe a server would be good to do that. I don't know, some kind of continuous integration or continuous deployment tool.
Yeah.
Who knows? So back at that time, there was all this interesting stuff happening around things like, is there a better way? And, you know, and of course, a lot of the sort of patterns that came from that, things like that, thinking about Postel's law, thinking about things like expand contracts for every API versioning, or when you're building services and versioning services, but also doing things like using not using auto-generated clients, you know, so not taking your WSDL and building clients from that and including those, but instead using things like XPath and JSONPath a bit later, using lighter-weight tools like Schematron, RelaxNG over XML schema and things. And that was as a result, learning about these technologies from my colleagues, really, because Jim Weber and Ian Robinson, obviously former colleagues of ours, were in London at the time. Jim had moved from Australia. And they were talking about things like Gorilla SOA, which is, I think deserves to be more widely talked about, actually, Gorilla SOA, which was Jim's, Jim Weber's thinking around how you avoid the sort of the big SOA implementations that were called, hey, give us 100 million quid and 3 years and we'll SOA you up, you'll get, at the end of it, you'll SOA and it'll be great. And of course,
just to interject, my argument for that is give me 50 million quid and I'll do just as good a job. It won't work either.
Actually, you give me, I'll do it for 250 billion, right? I mean, I don't know why they didn't go up. Jim's thing with Gorilla SOA was very much around how do you bring agile thinking or the idea of walking skeletons. So what's the thinnest slice of value we can build for your services in your service-oriented architecture and get it out in front of clients making money, right? And or doing what it's supposed to do, delivering value. And so he was talking about that a lot of the time. He then had people like Stefan Tilghoff talking about RESTful integration as well. You had Arjen Poetsma, who was just joined the Spring project. The Spring was pretty new then. And Spring was migrating from just an IRC container towards the sort of behemoth that it is today, but that included doing things like replacing the web service integration with things like REST. So they had the web service integration, but they also had REST templates, and Arjen works on REST template. So there was all sort of bubbling around. Obviously, domain-driven design was happening as well. I remember I did a talk with Daniel Tilhorst North in ThoughtWorks at one of our internal events called Programming in the Large, and it was about the stuff that you see on big projects that might confuse you. And one of the slides we had in that was have a domain model. Yeah. I mean, it might sound strange, right? But I mean, you remember those days, it was like everything was just a ring or an int. Fine, right? Well, who needs more than that? Objects are expensive. If you have objects, that's going to slow things down, especially in banking. That was a received wisdom. So, all these sort of ideas around domain models, around minimizing coupling, cohesion, and maximizing cohesion, and integration was sort of bubbling around in my head. And then I was lucky enough, I was invited by Daniel to this North. He's sort of writ large in my career, Daniel, along with a few others. He invited me to something called the Software Architecture Workshop, which I was incredibly privileged to get to spend time with a group once a year. It's like an unconference that happens once a year.
I've been to a couple of those, yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're fascinating events because it's you never know where you're going to go over the 3 days.
Yeah.
You end up with a theme after 3 days, but you never know what it's going to be to start with. I went to one in, I guess, maybe 2010, 2011, around there. And, the usual suspects were around. So people from, there was Udi De Haan, obviously, and Sergius Bus, but he was a messaging expert. We had Stefan Tilghoff was there, RESTful, service-oriented architecture dude. Software-contained systems later on. We had Gregor Hope was there, Jimmy Nielsen from the driven design community, and a bunch of others. And really, we were, over the course of the 3 days, we ended up talking a lot about why are these big things so hard to change? How do we scale teams around these big things that we're building? Or how do we evolve products? What constraints can we use to evolve our products in the right way when they're these big things so that they... we minimize technical debt and when's the right time to tackle technical debt? We've solved that problem, is it okay to take a week out or 2 weeks out to do technical debt sprints and these sorts of things? And I think for me, I remember it as the end of that. I had, it's only ever happened once this time, one time in my life. But you know, people talk about having like eureka moments. Mm. You know, classically in the bath. Well, I wasn't in the bath. Yeah. I was in a hotel room in Casa Brando. And I literally, I was lying in bed thinking about the course of the day. And I honestly, it sounds bizarre, but it was like, there was like a bing, like almost like a, glass shattering moment. And suddenly just, what if we're doing it all wrong? What if we build, what rather than solve the problem of evolving the big things, why don't we solve for that and build smaller things?
Yeah.
And I remember running down to breakfast the next morning, and Jimmy Nielsen was there with his lovely wife and the kids were there. I went running, they were literally just leaving. I ran, Jimmy. I was just sort of blabbering at Jimmy. He was looking at me in his incredibly calm, slightly quizzical kind of manner, this exuberant Welshman suddenly running up to him, you know, kind of, I've got this idea. And really, it sort of came from there for me. I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, as I say, as I've said many times, there was sort of parallel evolution, convergent evolution of these things. So,
yeah.
You know, we had Dan North talking about replaceable component architectures. Fred George was in his developer and programmer anarchy stage, and he was talking about all those tiny services.
Yeah.
We had Adrian Cockcroft, obviously, at Netflix. He was talking about fine-grained service-oriented architectures at scale. You know, they were building stuff at scale at Netflix at the time. And so there was, I think it was just a set of ideas whose time had come, if you like.
Yeah.
To be honest, I mean, there's, and of course, everyone knows each other anyway, right? Daniel's ex-ThoughtWorks, Fred George's ex-ThoughtWorks, Adrian Cockcroft is big mates with Jim and Ian from integration from circles. So there's just there's a group of people whose ideas are circulating, and I think the time had really arrived when it was possible to do all the things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I talk about XP being, well, I don't, you know, XP is doing all the things and turning up to 11. I think microservices is similar to that. And without being able to do things like, you know, spin up environments automatically, which you can do with the cloud, because obviously AWS was starting to become, you know, moving into the ascendancy. I think the complexity which you push into the infrastructure wouldn't have been worth it until about that point. So I'm sure many other people have lots of these ideas beforehand. You could argue that Alan Kay, you know, when he talked about object orientation as, what does he say, message, I'm paraphrasing, message processing, encapsulation. And
I did something in the early 90s. I worked for a startup that was a guy that worked in IBM, and he came up with a concept for what he called cooperative business objects. I worked in this startup that built the infrastructure to support these cooperative business objects. So essentially, to a very large extent, separating the essential complexity of the system from the accidental complexity, and you built the system from a series of these things. We got a bunch of things right. We invented XML before XML was a thing, in order to make it, to make the kind of communication, so you could have flexible communications, and it did some really cool things. I think, you know, we also got a bunch of things wrong, but we had a programming model for building systems in COBOL, very very object oriented systems in COBOL, which was interesting, but a bunch of other languages too. But it was really fascinating, and that got me really interested in kind of service based design ideas. Yeah. Then I think, and one of the things that's always surprised me is that I can't think of any programming language or system that really surfaces the idea of a service. And that seems weird, because it seems like such a broad, natural division of responsibility in design.
Hmm.
But every time I've ever done it, and that's nearly every system that I've built since the 1990s, it's, you know, you have to come up with your own conventions and protocols for what you mean by the edge of a service.
Yeah.
And that seems a bit strange.
It does. I guess you could argue that Erlang came King Places.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
Which is, you know, essentially probably, you could argue them, the most true Zamenhof's idea of object orientation. I think Daniel Tillis North, again, he's got a quote about one of his quotes. You know, it's the Greenspan's 10th law. Where it's the Greenspan's 10th law is any sufficiently complicated, paraphrasing, sufficiently complicated object-oriented system will contain a half implemented bug-ridden version of half of common Lisp, right? That's the I think you replace those with microservices and, you know, and Erlang, right? So any microservices implementation contains a half-assed bug-ridden implementation of half of Erlang. Exactly. I mean, I fully agree. You know, when I was on Thoughtworks, I went to several investment banks, and it was quite natural when you're sitting working with traders to build lots of small things.
Yeah,
you know, because you haven't got time not to build lots of small things. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, do you mind if I just take a week? Because yes, you can have that, but I'm going to take a week to change this first. And it's going to take. You can't do that if you've got an opportunity in 3 days' time. So and then Martin came to visit a project I was working on, and being Martin with his, "Oh, this seems like an interesting idea. You should write an article for my website." Blah 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 blah. That was in 2012, I think, or 2011, and then it took me 3 years and he invited me to a sleepover in his house in Boston, and we eventually wrote it up in 2014. So yeah.
But he kidnapped you to write the article.
Basically, it's the only way. I always loved it about this with Eric. Eric Tinnenberg, obviously a mutual friend of ours. And I was saying, it's terrible. I find writing difficult, really do. I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I find it difficult to get started. Yeah. And he said, well, you know, it turns out you're quite good at communicating in other ways. You're quite good on stage. You're quite good at interviewing people and things like that. So I guess we don't all have to be the same, do we? So.
No. Probably good if we're not, because everybody'd have a YouTube channel.
I'm launching my. You know,
so
I'm actually on Twitch every night, Dave. That's
that's why. Yeah. So semantic diffusion's a thing. Everybody that I know of that's come up with an idea that's become popular, kind of. At least sub-vocally says, "I didn't mean that." So what things do you wish that people more understood about microservices, or that they missed?
That's a really good question. So I came up with this really catchy term, which never caught on. Right, not microservices. That was a kind of group effort, and then when it appeared on Martin's site, that's it, right? You're done, because it stays on Martin's site. But no, I came up with this idea of, I think it was called the microservices integration pattern organizational onion, which is not great there.
It's not quite as catchy, is it?
It's not. And it was when I was talking about Comey's Law a lot. I did a series of talks on Comey's Law, you know, why I learned to stop worrying and embrace Comey's Law and so on. And one of the things I talked about in that is, much like, you know, I see functions and methods, objects, service microservices, and then collections of these things as, it's like, you know, you start at the macro, and then as you get deeper and deeper, it's kind of fractal. The same structure repeats itself until you get down to the methods and the class or whatever, right? So I sort of see it as this, the turtles all the way down until you hit the VM. That's what it's all sitting on, all the OS. And in my mind, when you sort of chunk up from the smaller things to the bigger things, you know, you chunk up from the method to the class, to the class to the library or the namespace to a service into groups of collaborated services, and then in my mind, the whole thing was about how teams are organized around those as well. So that there is a similar structure, a similar fractal nature to the organizations building these things.
Yeah.
So as you chunk up to, you know, larger organizational units, if it's a team of people, then who are managing a number of services, maybe whatever that's 5, 6, whatever it is, 10, you know, that's from the outside is opaque. You don't need to know, you know.
Yeah.
And as you have these groups of teams collaborating via these external service interfaces, I think that the trendy phrase is, you know, hard on the outside, soft in the middle, right? So,
yeah,
you know, the domain boundaries are very clear, defined by, as you were saying, you know, yeah, very clear application protocols that we don't have to invent every time. We use standard ones like the web ones, W3C standards, to talk to one another. And then those teams are then chunked up again into a number of teams implementing a business capability.
Yeah.
So, and I think the idea of the business capability was the thing that we didn't quite get across. So I think people say business capability is synonymous with a bounded context, or somewhat synonymous with some of the domain designs, when they're not, you know, because business capabilities tend to be big, fairly big things to first order. If zeroth order, they're massive, but first order, they're, you know, they're sort of warehouse management. There's a lot going on in warehouse management, and only some of it is software.
Yeah,
that's the key thing. There's people, there's the processes those people are following, there's the tools that they're doing to use them to do their work. And, you know, so if you're talking about microservices organized around business capabilities, there's a set of microservices organized around as management, right?
Yeah.
Which are some of those tools.
Yeah.
And I think that's led, I don't know if it's definitely correlation between a sort of misunderstanding of that and this sort of fractal nature, and how they should be completely decoupled across these big capabilities.
Yeah.
And the fractal nature of them inside, to this microservice soup thing, anti-pattern, which you see a lot of, right? Which is, you've got, oh, well, hey, I've got 2,000 microservices and I have to deploy them all at once. Microservices are rubbish. Thank God. That is what I did. We never said do that, right?
2,000 microservices and 10 developers,
10 developers, 2,000 microservices. We can only deploy them every 2 years because we've got 8. You're not winning at anything if you've ended up there. So I think that is one of the things I wish we'd spent more time talking about. But the thing is, it's a really hard topic, like, because any of these domains, you know, when you start talking about domains, where do the domain boundaries fall?
Yeah.
And I guess one other thing is the products and project idea.
Mm-hmm.
I still think we're doing. Many organizations have moved, modern digital organizations have moved to product mode, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But I still wonder how many of those are aligned with the way the finance of the organization works, right? So, and because for me, project thinking is as much about financing things as it was about anything else. And I think a lot of the questions you get, which is, oh, but, you know, if I have a product team, what happens if they run out of work?
Yeah.
That's kind of, for me, like, doesn't make any sense at all. Well, if they run out of work and features, right?
Yeah.
Then they can improve the software that they're working on. They can improve the processes that they're using. They can improve the tooling they're using to do their job. So there's always stuff to do. They can learn about new stuff so they're ready to pivot when they need to. But I still think we're stuck in this mode of activity focused. We need to, you know, all our people need to be busy, even if they're in product teams, rather than this idea that I talked about back in Australia with you, probably, actually, which is, I think I call it building software that's never done.
This
idea that we continually, and again, these, oh, my boundaries are wrong, oh, I've made a mistake. That's fine. Change the boundaries. If you're in a product team, long-lived team, change the boundaries. You know, who's going to say no, you know? So those are, I guess, two things.
It's
all tied up with deployability, essentially, as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of my big things. So one of the things that I've said a few times, I think publicly, about microservices is that I think that fundamentally they are an organizational scalability play. That's what they're for, really. It's allowing teams the autonomy to make progress more independently of others. And so you must decouple, and that gets to the heart to the deployability question. You know, if you are building your microservice and then testing it with all of the rest before you release, you haven't got microservices, you've got a distributed monolith, and that's not the same things, and an inefficient one. So, you know, if you want a distributed monolith, there are more efficient ways of doing it. If you want microservices
in process,
absolutely. But the huge deal it seems to me is that, and I know that you and Martin said this in your original article, is that the problem with proper microservices is that it takes a level of design sophistication and skill that is probably a little bit uncommon. And that's a challenging thought. So I see lots of teams that adopt it as a default strategy and go slower as a result and probably build worse software as a result than if they did something else, which is a shame because it's nothing. Because I still think, you know, microservices is, if you have the scalability thing, it's the thing to do. It's the best way of organizing things.
I agree 100% with everything you said then. You know, it's interesting how we do end up in these distributed monoliths. I find the whole thing about, so there's two things actually, two observations. The first thing is that microservices has never been on adopt on the ThoughtWorks tech radar. Right, we've never put it into adopt, and that's deliberately because it talks to your point there about it not being 101.
Yeah.
Instead of 101 skills that you need, it takes experience. It takes seeing some things at scale done right, I think, to do it.
Yes.
The second thing is, it's an organizational scale problem, or in some senses, it could be another scale problem as well, right? So the original thing I used was Java, the Unix way. The talk was called, I did it on the subject. And we had a weird set of requirements, really strange set of requirements. I mean, they're all requirements are strange, but it wasn't just building a website, right? You know, it was building a loyalty management platform from scratch, which is essentially like building a retail bank from scratch. It's very much the same set of issues. And with the same scaling issues around, how many transactions per second can you process? How do you onboard, you know, how do you avoid batches, overnight batches? Yeah. How do you order to update account? Can you onboard 10 million people, you know, over the course of some number of hours or whatever it is, if we open up a new country. So these sort of interesting, bursty, high transaction per second, relatively latency, not like a lot. I know a lot of stuff you've done at LMAX. They also led us down the path towards building a distributed system. And there was also a time to market question there as well, which talks organizational scale, which is we need to do this. And if we don't do this by the time our competitors are ready to release their version of the thing or their new version of the thing, then what are we bringing to the market? So we need to get this out in a way that's going to make sense for the business. But all, you know, and to do that, parallelization is a thing. And I think one of the things with microservices, organizing around these, you know, business case, et cetera, is you get to parallelize certain things. Because they're decoupled, right? So you can work on something independent from another thing, as long as you have, going back to what you were saying, these defined domain application protocols.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another thing, actually, and we don't talk about anymore, really. Everyone seems to have gone back to building their own custom in-house, you know, message formats for, you know, Kafka streams and all that, which, again, seems to be going backwards.
Yeah,
because you know we talked in the article about battle-tested standards, not homegrown standards.
Yeah,
you know, there's a reason things get into the W3C. It's not, and it's because they work, right? You don't get in there unless they work. Right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's so using these sort of common approaches to integration. You know, again, Leonard Richardson's maturity model, which is lost in the depths of time again, you know, but, you know, URIs, you know, HTTP and hypermedia, they're in there for a reason. Those characteristics that they provide are super useful if you're building systems of systems.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We've kind of started slightly straying into territory of another topic that I'm interested in talking to you about. Another piece of work that you've been doing with Ian Cartwright and somebody whose name I've forgotten is the patterns of legacy displacement. And you were talking about using microservices as a way of kind of isolating work and allowing you to kind of, you know, address some of these broader problems. But could you explain a little bit about the patterns of legacy displacement. I was reading through some of those, and there's some really interesting ideas in there.
So full, let's just caveat this, full disclosure, this started as me, and they're going to say nonsense, James, but this I really wanted Ian and Rob to start writing up the things that were in their head. And I've made a contribution myself.
Yeah.
But in the reality is, this is all the amazing stuff that Ian and Rob have done over the years, and the, you know, the learnings that they're sort of bringing to working on these big, long-running, you know, change programs. So, in terms of what do we want to do with that? I think what we wanted to do is sort of say, everyone knows what the strangler. Well, everyone will say strangler fig. Right? How do you get rid of legacy? Oh, we strangle it. We're going to use the strangler fig pattern. But what does that mean actually? Right. I mean, there is a conversation that says all of the patterns that we're talking about, and there's a ton which we haven't written up yet, are an attempt to answer the what is the strangler fig actually? You know, it's a set of these little techniques you can use when faced with a set of forces, hence the patterns, that will provide you hopefully with an outcome or at least a way forward. So we talk, obviously, in the original one, it's very much an example based on our colleagues as part of a longer running program where they removed a bunch of middleware basically and replaced it they removed a bunch of databases and removed it and replaced it with something a little bit more sensible than that. So than just integration via database to database. But I think what we wanted to do is also provide not recipes, that's too much, but this idea that actually there is a process you can go through which will hopefully end you up in a better place. And when we talk about this is, you know, first of all, you need to understand the outcomes you want to achieve, right? So, and very rarely the outcome is just replace the existing thing. Or it might seem like that if you ask people in IT. But if you step outside that box, if you go and talk to people in the business, if you go and talk to people who's affected by the systems they have to use on a day-to-day basis, what you'll often find is things like, you know, it's a classic one. I was at a retailer and they had a bunch of legacy systems, and we were asked to do some analysis on these. They had like hundreds of Eclipse rich client applications talking to WebSphere and then DB2 behind it. Mm-hmm. And they had loads of these things, and they were very proud of them all. And then we went and talked to the business folks about how they were using these tools. And they said, well, what we do is we open them up at the start of the day. It takes 10 minutes for each thing to load. So we'll load up this application. We'll see what the overnight batch has produced. We will then download that into Microsoft Access. We'll export it into Access. We then work in Access all day, right, as a team. And at the end of the day, some poor sod's going to then upload it all. That's all right. This is a tool that's fundamentally not fit for purpose. And there were lots of these things. And so I use that as an example of shadow IT, right? So it's software that has been provided that isn't capable of doing the job that's needed by your colleagues. You know, no one is delighted to be using that software. Yeah. So understand the outcomes you want to achieve. Yes, there's reducing costs of change, improving business processes, retiring old systems and so on. But there's also making people's lives fundamentally better when they come to work, right? And I think that's the first one big mistake I think we see a lot is it becomes a technical exercise.
Yes.
In reducing cost or whatever it is, which actually the opportunity is there to rethink the problem.
It's one of the kind of self analyses of my own work that realizations, I suppose, that I've come to in recent years is that all of my stuff really is about outcome focus rather than, you know, inside out focus. It's about, you know, what is it that we're trying to achieve and then trying to optimize for that, whatever it is, you know, whether it's speed or, you know, customer fit or any of those things, and then using technology to help you do that. And I do think that seems rarer than you might hope.
Yeah. And the smallest amount of technology possible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Minimize.
It's when you do right, you know. It's,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
the truth. I remember when I was at ThoughtWorks, there was a term that we used to talk about, roller skate integration, somebody was working on a project for a bank, and they were trying. The job was to integrate these two systems, and they got it working in the first couple of weeks by literally hiring some kids who would roller skate with bits of paper between the systems and type them in from one system to another. So they talked about roller skate integration as a stepping stone to getting the full integration done. So they kind of abstracted the thing so it could spit out something relevant that they could give the kids to roller skate over the other side of the office to put into the other system. But I always loved that. And that's another one of those ideas that I really like in terms of the sort of evolutionary design, is kind of using design as a tool to hide the stuff that you can't do yet, or you don't defer decision making. And I think that's such a powerful idea.
That's a brilliant example. We used to talk again, American Thoughtworks, probably when you were there, about like the 1950s enterprise. It was obviously, you know, it's like a thought experiment. Okay, well, how would this be done if it was the 50s and there were no computers, right?
Yes.
You'd have inboxes, and you'd have outboxes, right? You would do your thing and you'd put your thing in the outbox. Or how would you book a holiday in the 1950s? Yes. You know, you would fill in the form, put the form in the outbox, and it would go into the internal mail at the end of the day, and then eventually you'd get this thing. This is that, except on roller skates.
Yes.
Yes, swivel chair integration. I mean, it's as well swivel chair. They went.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying. There's no surprise, I'm sure. But my wife works for. She's a civilian. She's a civilian that works for the police service.
Yeah.
In the UK, and her job is basically wrangling three different systems across three different domains. So courts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And literally, her job is copying stuff.
Yeah.
From not a job. I mean, she does a lot more. Very much what she does, but the mechanics. Is copying stuff from one place to another, right? She's obviously making big decisions about various things, but it's her job would be, her life would be so much easier if rather than have to do that, someone actually sat with those people doing their jobs and realized, And I think that's the thing with legacy replacement. That's the opportunity. That's the big opportunity. Yes, you might not have to pay IBM for more MIPS, whatever it is, right? Because your mainframe is too overloaded. Or yes, you might need to take advantage of some new features and new technology, whatever. But that's the key. That's the goal. That'd be the thing worth going after, I think.
Yeah.
On my soapbox here, Dave. I was so passionate about this.
One of my friends, so in the late 90s when Java was a new thing, one of my friends was working on a project to re-implement a data entry system. I can't remember if it was retail or banking or whatever, but he was re-implementing this data entry system, and they did this kind of funky, nice user interface and all this kind of thing. And the people that were doing the data entry absolutely hated it. So eventually my friend went and kind of sat with them and realized that they knew the green screen terminal system so well. They got all the hotkeys right under their fingers. So they were 10 times faster putting stuff into that system than they were using a mouse to point and click it to some what was then a sexy looking graphical user interface. You need to focus on where the people really are and what they really need to help them do their job.
Yeah,
and that's it's so important. It's one of the ideas from extreme programming that was mentioned by Kent Beck that so often is missed. Is you've got to be involved with the real customer. You've got to understand things from their perspective, and it doesn't matter whether the customer's a programmer or an end user. Through a website or whatever, but you've got to think from those perspectives, it seems to me.
I think absolutely, and it really I was sort of thinking then, because I was asked at an event I was at recently, it was one of these things, I think each speaker was asked, what advice or what characteristics do you think make a successful programmer, architect, whatever. And the one I chose, I thought about it for a bit because I was giving it in advance. I thought about it a bit. And actually, I came up with empathy was the thing I came up with.
Yeah, yeah.
I think empathy is one of the absolute crucial things that you need to have if you're thinking about building things for other people, which is what we're doing most.
Absolutely. You've got to put yourself in their place and imagine using your software to do what they're trying to do.
Exactly that. And if actually if replacing the green screen because with the same keystrokes is going to make their lives better, then that's the right thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
Same with investment, same with traders.
Yeah.
You don't want to be changing any key bindings for them if you're going to get any input.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's that's part of it at the start.
Yeah.
You know, understanding those icons. But then there's the patterns about how do you find the seams? So there's a bunch of analysis patterns essentially to start with. You know, that's really what we'll come to is how do you do things like create town plans in a lightweight way as possible using Wordly maps and other tools. But then you sort of come on to how do you break the problem up and how do you identify seams in the software and in the organization. And often what we say is you go and look at your company, look at the business.
Yeah.
Right. Because there are seams already there, right? So they'll give you a bit of a head start. There's some really exciting work being done by a couple of my colleagues at the moment, Shona Seth and Tom Colgrave and a guy called Alexi as well, I forget his surname, which they've just published on Martin's site. About using, and this is, I think, a really exciting use of Gen AI, right? Of using Gen AI to analyze big old hairy code bases, where it's not like because finding seams in these things, especially if you've got, you know, there's one example I had recently, which was 250 million lines of COBOL. So it's a lot of lines of COBOL, and no one knows what they do, right? So, so how do you actually find seams in there? They've had some really intriguing results initially using a combination of actually of knowledge graphs. So they're using Neo4j to build knowledge graphs. They're using RAG, these so they've got a vector database which they're using to populate that based on the AST. And then an LLM then to the integrate with an LLM for the computational to draw inferences and stuff. And that's really exciting because you can, it started off with you saying things like, what does transaction ID mean? And it'll go and find in all the documentation, it'll find look at code and it'll have a good guess at what that means. And then you can say, okay, where's, if I change transaction ID, where do I need to change it? And it'll give you a bunch of stuff. But then you can also, they've started now exploring whether you can find these coarser grain seams, so capabilities, So can you describe the structure of this software in the large sort of questions? And that's fascinating, I think.
So looking for candidates for decomposition?
Yes, exactly. I mean, obviously then the proof's in the pudding is obviously hard. Pick a lot of stuff, you know. I remember, I won't say which bank, it was a retail bank, and they asked us some advice on whether we should, so they've been working for 18 months to try and extract user journeys from their banking website, the customer banking website, and they've done two in 18 months, and they were like, they came to us and said, look, you know, we're just going really slowly. Can you provide any advice on whether we should continue to do this, whether we should rewrite it, whatever? And I managed to spend half a day with the code base and ran it through a few homegrown tools that I've sort of knocked up using D3 and things. And structure 101, which provides dependency matrices. And I said at the end, I said, look, I've got good news and I've got bad news when we represent back. So the good news is you've got quite a cohesive code base. Yeah. And then the bad news is it's all of it.
I thought it was funny.
It's one of the only times I've actually ever said to someone, one of the rare occasions where the advice has been, I think you need to start from scratch. It also led to Daniel North's law of if-else statements or conditionals, which is there's no correct number. Because if you've got one, obviously you've got just an if this, then of course you can add another condition. But if you've got like these, this code base did like 60 levels of nested events. Of course you're going to add another one, because you can't, what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure whether these things are related or not, but it seems to me that I can spot a kind of fuzzy relationship between this and one of the other areas of your interest that I saw you talk about in one of your recent conference presentations, which was generative science and using agent-based simulation to simulate processes and things like that. So one of the examples that you gave that I particularly liked was showing the efficiency of working in small steps iteratively versus working in larger batch sizes in a waterfall kind of style, and the dramatic change in efficiency, and graphing that and showing those sorts of things. So, and at the end in the presentation, there was kind of a throwaway comment that you were saying that you're looking at taking this further and including lots of other things. So I was kind of intrigued by that and where you're at with it. So could you explain a little bit about what it is, what you're trying to do with it, and where you plan to go?
Yeah, I mean, I find the whole thing fascinating, and it's actually related to a lot of the events I've actually been at with you, Dave, and you can't really talk with all these different places. You sort of lose track of where, but certainly, and also, you know, this idea of, are we engineers now, right? So, because I remember being in GoTo Chicago, and Dr. Anita Singh-Gupta was doing a keynote on her work on the Curiosity rover, the lander bit, and actually the parachute. So, how you get from space onto the ground, right? I don't know if you, I know you know her
I do.
As well. excuse me. And one of the things she said, which was, I mean, she said lots of amazing things in that, but there was a question at the end. So someone, you know, one of us, like, you know, cocky software engineers in the audience said, what happens if something goes wrong? What redundancy did you have built in? And she almost like just started laughing. Well, she did. She started laughing at the concept. She said, look, you know, this is space. You can't build redundancy in, right? Because redundancy is expensive. You know, you can't have multiple ways of doing the same thing or multiple different, fail safes and stuff, because any weight is more fuel, you know, to get out of the Earth's gravity well, etc. And she said, so what we like to do is rely on a little thing we call engineering tolerances, right? And there was 2,000 people in the room. There was this sort of like, oh, everyone in the room went, that's a thing, isn't it, in other branches of engineering. And she went on to explain that what she meant was, yes, obviously engineering tolerances, but then all the other tools that they use in order to test things as much as they possibly can locally before going into
It's
just the environment we know, which is space, right? So and so she talks about simulations. It talks about models, scale models. You know, turns out we haven't got Mars, Martian atmosphere, but you can stick a scale model in the desert, you know, and drive it around and see how it works. But starting with models, starting with simulations and things. So that made me think, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that we do in software. We take decisions about the design and evolution of the systems themselves, but also about how the humans that build these systems are organized.
Yeah.
And often we don't do it, but, you know, we do it, I'm sure, with as much empathy as possible.
Yeah.
But the problem is, time is a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're taking decisions about, hey, we're going to restructure into Spotify model, or we're going to use this other thing, or we're going to become, this is flat, that plays out in real time. It has no option but to play out in real time. So you don't see the effect of that until much later on. And much later on, you might have ruined people's lives. You might have caused your staff to leave. You might have, people might have, it causes huge amounts of stress or whatever it is.
You might be Twitter. Right.
Well, exactly. Look at Twitter. Look at Twitter. So I got to thinking, well, you know, maybe we could learn from some of these other engineers out there and think about whether there are ways to test that without actually doing it, right?
Yes.
Now, so hence this idea of, I call it Sim Enterprise, was born. And it's based on good science. It's based on generative science, so based models, turns out there are other forms of AI other than LLMs and machine learning, which have been used for decades to explore interesting domains and interesting problems. And the one in that same talk, I used NetLogo, which is a fun language, multi-turtle language, to sort of demonstrate what happens with congestion collapse in systems that are prone to that, right? Motorways, for example.
Yeah.
You know, you put too many cars on a motorway for a given speed, you will start backing up. That's just the system and how it works. It's called congestion collapse. And you can model that using agents. And you can also show that if you change the minimum speed or you change the number of cars on the motorway, then you get into a steady state. You don't undergo the phase transition into congestion collapse. But the same thing happens on teams, of course, right? So we get the same problem when we're constantly context switching, we've got too much stuff to do, blah blah blah. That system is also prone to congestion collapse, and you can see this when everyone's working really hard but nothing's coming out. And often what you're observing congestion collapse in that team, so you can understand lots of these interesting things. Coming back to the graphing, what we set this simple model up to do is model like a single piece of a team working using a single piece flow. So every time a piece of work is available for someone who can do that piece of work and they're free, they'll pick that bit of work up, do it, and then be passed on through the software development lifecycle. This is what we term waterfall, which is really 100% batch size. So all the requirements go through each stage.
Yes.
And, you know, you can look at one of my favorite books, Principles of Product Development Flow, the amazing Don Reinerson wrote that decades ago now. And you can look at the maths and you go, that makes sense. He says, if you half cycle time, you double throughput, right? That's the math relationship between the two. And you go, oh, yeah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got convincing, you know, he's got the maths in the equation. Oh, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's much more powerful, I thought, if you can show it, if you can see it happening.
Yes.
Actually, you might get it, but actually, if you can see it in a simulated environment, you can see not just that the cycle time is massively improved, but crucially, how much extra stuff, bananas, coins, whatever it is, you get as a result. Because the compounding factor of deploying continuously in small batches is enormous over time. You know, so that's what I was excited about exploring, and I think you might have even seen the original version I did in NetLogo a long time ago, something probably 2017. Yeah. Then I rewrote it in Python. I then rewrote it over lockdown in C#. And I had a couple of colleagues join, Mike Mason, join to help. I wrote this brilliant, it was lovely. I was getting worried about how I was going to show stuff. And Mike said, well, just use ASCII art. So I had like in the log file, I had an ASCII art card wall. but because WebAssembly is a thing, I then included it in a Blazor application that you could run it on the web. And my mate Anthony joined as well. He said he looked quizzical after he sort of looked at the code base. He said, James, you know, for someone who's getting on a bit, your code's quite good.
Turns
out if you can only write code by writing tests first, I can't write code the other way now. You write fairly good code, right? Even if you don't do it very often. So
I'll pick you up on something that you said in one of your other presentations, which was that you were on the fence about whether what we do is engineering. I pick up on Anita Sengupta as well. My argument is not that what we do is engineering. My argument is that it ought to be. So I think that when you do it, it works a lot better. And one of the things is that it doesn't mean that you're going to get perfect results. So one of the things about, you know, to counter Anita's argument is that I can't remember the proportions now, but a huge proportion, I think a majority of Mars missions failed. The thing was destroyed on entry. There's, you know, that's a really, really common failure because it's bloody hard because you have to get it perfectly right first time. And even with all of that focus on what could possibly go wrong, just as a sidebar, I love Margaret Hamilton's thing, who wrote the flight control systems for the Apollo program. And she talked about, you know, they focused all of the time on their how important it was for their systems to work, because it was what she called man-rated, because if stuff went wrong, it killed people.
Yeah.
And so that idea of thinking about how can, whatever it is, whatever scale, how can this go wrong? And then the engineering mindset is, how do I mitigate or eliminate that cause of failure? Yes. And the other thing, it seems to me, is that we have a huge advantage over physical engineering, because we have complete control. We can design our systems to be testable. We can design our systems to be more deterministic. We can experiment them on them and try them out, and all of these things, if we decide to do it. So I think it's that's my quick elevator pitch for engineering over craft.
There's some really interesting things that sparks me saying that in my head, right? So, I mean, one of the things about what we do, of course, is, you know, materials are more or less free, right?
Yes.
Until we're living in that science fiction Ian Banks culture future where matter is essentially matter, and you can just, you know, using something like that we would think is magic, build a bridge, and then, oh, I don't like that, just dissolve. Yeah. Build another bridge, dissolve. Yeah. Build another. You can't do that at the moment with physical
energy.
Whereas with us, we can. We can. I'm sure you've done this in the past as well, but one of the lovely things that I used to do when I started pairing with someone new, or someone, you know, maybe a grad or more junior person joining the team, or you're working with a client who wasn't used to working in our really tight loops, you know, tight flats, you write a test, you write the code, test passes, commit onto the mainline, right? I mean, that's what I'm referring to there. Is also writing the test, writing some code and going, oh, that's rubbish. Reverse.
Yeah, yeah.
Delete
yeah.
the model, right? Yeah. And the looks in people, what have you done? You've deleted the code. Yeah, it was going to work, was it?
Yeah.
And that's another, I talk about in another talk, another one of my talks on sort of touches on evolutionary architecture, that every line of code is an option, and either creates or collapses options in the future. And so why should you knowingly follow a path that's going to lead to you collapsing your options in the future, when actually what you can do is just, especially, and obviously it works if you're in small increments, right?
Yeah.
But that's what I think we should be doing. So, yeah.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just coming back to one of the things I was sort of saying in that talk about, I mean, I'm not really on the fence. I think we are more, you know, if we do the things that we can, that we do and that we know work, then I think we're most of the way there, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
So build pipelines, which we have you and Jez and your other collaborators in the UK a long time ago to thank for. CI, you know, building a single artifact, it being traceable to the commits that went to make that artifact, it moving through a build pipeline where it's tested for fast feedback initially, and then for more coverage later on in the build pipeline, having all the tools we've got now, Canary releasing, you know, blue green, all these things. This idea I talked about, production isn't live. You know, you're not live until you get in traffic. You can have 50 versions of a thing out there.
Yeah.
If only one of them is getting traffic, who cares, right? I mean, maybe it costs you money on your T2 account, on your AWS account. But also, the stuff that was hard to change is now becoming easier.
Yes.
So where are we deploying? You know, there's in that talk, I tell a story about building a science publishing site, and we realized, who knew that having compute in the UK and data in the US was probably not going to work. How do we then make that change? Well, it was about three lines of code.
Yes.
In our infrastructure as code, we're using Terraform, about three lines of code.
Yeah.
And we stood up the entire new thing in the US and pulled out the one, you know. That's a
spot. Imagine if you'd built a data center or two data centers.
Yes. So you've got that, but then you've got also the stuff that, you know, Neil Ford, Rebecca Parsons, and Pat Qua talk about a lot in evolutionary architecture, fitness functions. So, you know, removing some of the constraints the human constraints from things like change request boards or architecture review boards. You know, the architect says no meeting that happens once a month. You know, let's put those in the code. Let's put those and run those as part of our build pipeline. Yeah. Let's put our software supply chain testing into the build pipeline. Let's put audit into the build pipeline. Let's do these things. And at a certain point, you've got a process, and we're writing tests right up front. We're guiding our design using tests. Never going to be bug-free, but defect-free, clearly. But you can, you know, I think we can all agree we get less defects if we write lots of tests. You know, all that stuff. I think when you put it in aggregate, you know, your brilliant book. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. It was a
brilliant I'll buy you a beer.
No, it's something somewhere. Along with my giant game design. Honestly, I was building the simulation. I was like, oh, I need to know a bit about game design now. So I ended up buying this textbook. And it's like this thick. I'm going to finish it. And the last third is just about vectorization and about, you know, kind of not stalling your GPU pipeline. I'm like, I really need to know this. I don't know, but it's kind of, you know.
But now you do.
Yes. Yeah, now I do. Exactly. It turns out games are really simple. There's a loop and you call two methods, do stuff and do physics. Like, do render, render. That's it, pretty much. Right?
Yeah.
But I did learn a lot about some interesting techniques doing the simulator. So things like using some of the tools that game designers or game developers use for NPCs, AI, as we would say, but things like behavior trees are really interesting. Really interesting way of modeling finite state machines, which, if I need a finite state machine in the future, I would probably reach for that.
Yeah.
Because they're buggers to test finite state machines.
Yeah.
Behavior trees are really easy to test, and that's great. Yeah. You know, so,
I think looking at the time, we should probably start to wrap up. There's so many other things that we could talk about. So the stuff of yours that I've nicked that we haven't even covered, like the difference between the Santa Fe Institute stuff about the directed graphs versus meshes of interconnected systems.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff. We must get together again sometime and talk about some of this stuff. But for now, thank you, James, so much for your time and for your insights. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.